and what I'll be out to show now when we finish our derivation of why and how it is that national income equals consumption plus net investment, we'll see that most of the spending is actually under the heading of net investment, not consumption. And that's where we want to go right now. And so here I am at point three, an accurate conception, recognizing the role of productive expenditure. And I refer you to the step-by-step derivation of the equality between the sum of profits and wages on the one side, which is the essence of national income, and consumption plus net investment on the other, which is net national product. And we'll see why this equality is true, but we'll see that its significance is badly misinterpreted, that in fact most spending takes place under the head of net investment. And here we are. We got into this partway last week. We begin with the definitional proposition that national income, symbolized by Y, is equal to the sum of all profits and wages in the economic system. That's what national income is, the totality of profits and wages. And we understand under the heading of profits that we take profits gross of the interest that business firms pay, and we include any genuine net rental incomes, not imputed rental incomes, but genuine net rental incomes, like the profit that Hertz makes when it rents its cars, the profits that landlords make when they rent out their apartments. All of that belongs under the heading of profits. And also all of the interest paid by business firms, we'll include that with profit. So we've got the profits, corporate and individual and partnership profits, all of that under P for profits, and all wages and salaries under the heading W for wages and salaries. And then all we do, you see, what we're out to do, this is our starting point. Here's national income, it's equal to profit plus wages. What we want to end up with, what we want to show at the end, is just why and how this will equal consumption plus net investment. This will be step 12. We have a bunch of steps between 1 and 12. And as we get to the end, we'll see that most spending in the economy is actually productive expenditure. Here's productive expenditure. B, capital B, represents productive expenditure. Well, we've already used P for profit, so think of B as representing business spending, which is synonymous with productive expenditure. And we'll demonstrate at length that productive expenditure minus costs, that's equal to net investment. Now, what are these costs symbolized by D? And it's D, not C, because we're using C for consumption. That's the convention. C is consumption. So we're using D, think of deduction, and we're deducting the costs. All right. We start off, national income is the sum of profits plus wages. But what is the accounting expression for profits? How do you calculate profits? Profit is the difference between what and what?
Revenue and expenses.
Pardon me?
Revenue and expenses.
Revenue and expenses, or sales and costs. And here in equation two, I say profits are sales minus costs. Yes, Ms. Danko.
Can you speak a little bit louder?
Can I speak a little bit louder? Okay. All right, maybe I should turn up the volume on this a bit. All right, profits are sales minus costs. Now, we're calculating total profits in the entire economic system. P is not the profit of company X or Y. P is total profits of all firms in the entire economic system. So if we want to express the profits of all firms in the economic system, in terms of sales minus costs, we need to know the totality of all sales revenues in the economic system and the totality of all the costs deducted from all the sales revenues. So we could look at each firm's income statement. Each firm has a statement showing its sales revenues for a period of time and the cost that it deducts from those sales revenues to arrive at its profit. And we would want to add up the sales revenues of all firms in the entire economic system and subtract from them the totality of all costs deducted firm by firm, and that will give us total economy-wide aggregate profit. Any problems so far? That S, where S stands for total sales revenues, minus D, representing the cost deducted from sales revenues, S minus D is profit. Well, if we agree on that, now we can substitute equation 2 back into equation 1. Instead of saying profits plus wages equal national income, we'll say in equation 3, sales revenues minus costs plus wages equal national income. Any problem with this? Yes?
Sales minus costs plus wages.
Is national income. Sales minus costs alone is profit. But national income is not profit alone, it's profit plus wages. So sales minus costs plus wages is national income. Now notice, what sales revenues are we including here? If we return to our dead horse bread, flour, and wheat example, what sales revenues would be entering in from that sector of the economy? Yes?
I don't know if you want to go over this, but I was trying to do this on the quiz over the weekend.
Yeah.
And I was struggling with coming up with the, finding the aggregate profits. And that's what 2 would be, right? Sales minus?
Yes, sales minus costs is aggregate profit, yeah.
And it was just talking about demand for customers' goods.
Consumers' goods.
Money.
Consumers' goods, yeah.
Consumers' goods, right.
Yeah, okay.
And then also is demand for capital goods is 1,000 units of money. I was trying to figure out, what is the total sales in this equation?
Well, what do you think it is? Anyone have any idea?
It'd be $2,000.
Yeah, 2,000 units of money is total economy-wide sales revenues. Yeah.
And then subtract
whatever the total costs are.
Right.
And that will give you aggregate profit. What did I assume? 1,800 as total costs? Or?
300.
No, what did I assume for a total cost?
1,700.
Okay. So then profit would be 300. All right, so now notice, in terms of the sales revenues of bread, flour, and wheat, what is included in our figure of sales revenues?
Isn't this finished product here?
No, everything.
This is everything. See, are the only firms in the economy that make profits the producers of consumers' goods? Doesn't U.S. Steel make profits?
I thought your question was in regards to the bread, flour, and wheat.
Yeah.
Representation of, are we counting each one of those as an individually produced product or only the end product?
Well, what do you think we would have to do if we want to calculate total economy-wide profits in the economics?
We spent a lot of time last week talking about we have to calculate each aspect of that, but that represents
right.
double counting.
No, that does not represent double counting.
No, but I mean, that's the fallacy of what accepted practices, that would be double counting.
Okay, but hopefully we laid that to rest, maybe not. It keeps rising out of the grave. I'll have to get a silver bullet and a crucifix or something to keep it down. But we want to add up the total profits of all firms, right? All right. Are the bakers the only firms in connection with bread?
No.
Okay, who else's profits would we have to add up?
Farmers.
The farmers, the millers, everybody, the tractor producers. All right, now, if we're expressing profits as sales minus costs, then what are the sales figures that we'd be using? The sales of each. We'd have the receipts from the sale of bread, receipts from the sale of flour, receipts from the sale of wheat, everything all up and down the line.
So I guess that's why confusion comes in on a regular basis in this whole course, is that from what perspective is the question coming from? From the accepted practice or from what we're proposing to be?
Well, this is an alternative to the accepted practice, and what I'm attempting to do is to show how it is on the one side true that national income does equal consumption plus net investment. We'll see that is true, But nevertheless, most spending is under the head of net investment. It's productive expenditure. Now, even looking at things, here we are already just in equation two. We're expressing profits as sales minus costs. And this is aggregate profit, so it has to be aggregate economy-wide sales and aggregate economy-wide costs. Thinking of these things is not allowed in contemporary economics. You're not allowed to look at this, because what error are you allegedly making as soon as you would say total economy-wide sales revenues? Allegedly double counting. So you can never even think of total profits in the light of sales minus costs if you adhere to that. So as soon as we're looking at total economy-wide sales, we've put behind us the notion that we're dealing just with the final product. We're dealing with all the products, the so-called intermediate products as well as the final product. Yes, Mr. Weatherford.
Argue your point, but I'm thinking of a reality check here.
Yeah.
That you can't truly attain total revenues and total costs because so many businesses are not required to report those items.
Well, there might be some you couldn't obtain, but you could certainly make fairly good estimates. You can probably obtain the great bulk of them. All of the major corporations, their sales are a public record.
Right.
And however, you see, the same point could be made against any form of aggregate economic accounting. How is an estimate for total profits arrived at today? There are regularly published figures. Now, not everyone's data is a public record. And what is done is they use income tax data as a basis for estimation. And then there are certain things that you'd have to extrapolate and interpolate. So one way or another, it can be done. If you can estimate aggregate profit, you could estimate aggregate sales. And we could even do it, we could make some estimate starting with profits and making assumptions about profit margins. If you knew profits in various industries, and these figures are published, if you had an estimate of profit margins industry by industry, well, all you do is you take the profit margin and you take the reciprocal of that and you have an estimate of sales. And then you subtract the profit from the sales and you have an estimate of costs. So this would not be an especially difficult problem. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
Yes, sir. I have an interesting question. So, to the point that was made earlier when you dialogue with Jay, a lot of the things that we're learning in this course are not the traditional for the contemporary
right.
learning.
Right.
So, for practical purposes, as we go back into the business world, what's the proper posture? Like, we have this. Like, I've been fascinated by the fact that we've got this new thinking, right?
Yeah.
So Pepperdine must think, okay, this new thinking is the best thinking.
Well, the opinions best? Expressed in this class are not necessarily those of the Pepperdine management.
Rephrase the question.
Well, let me rephrase the question. All right, coming from this, obviously, Pepperdine is saying, listen, we're going to give you this business, you know, these business courses. When you leave here, you'll be better equipped to go out and have an impact in the business world.
Yeah.
And therefore, they must, you know, embrace what you're teaching to a certain degree. Let me just finish the question. To a certain degree, obviously. And so I'm not afraid of new thinking. My question is, as we go out as business persons, men and women, what's the best position to take with this thinking? How do we use it by saying, listen, you know, traditionally, you people have been doing things like this, but that's not really right. You know, it's not, using that example, it's not, you know, double counting. We should be considering it, you know, overall.
Mm-hmm.
Using a lot of the other examples that we've learned, what is your view on the best way to, I think that's what people's struggles are. How do we grab it and use it?
Well, it wouldn't be your job to proselytize or try to convert people. You need to know a lot more than you will at the end of this class. But it should be, hopefully, a spur to your own further thinking and search for knowledge. But whatever other people are saying, you should be able to comprehend where they're coming from, but you should also know more. Yes,
This is back to the double counting issue with that problem, though. I feel dumb at almost asking it because
that's okay. That's
sales minus demand, but
minus cost, yeah.
Minus cost, right? But you, when you need look at this problem, you need to think about it in a way of a double counting. You're counting it from the consumer standpoint, but before that, you're also counting it from the capital standpoint.
Yeah, but that is not double counting.
I know it's not. I realize it now, but. That's just kind of thinking out loud.
Okay.
Because it seems like a lot of people still are confused with what's double counting, what's not double counting.
The prevailing view is that when you count the bread or any final product, you're somehow also automatically counting everything that was previously connected with it, the flour and the wheat. That's
from the seed being bought.
Okay. All right. Anything. All up and down the line. And it's thought that since you're already counting them when you count the final product, you would be committing the error of double counting if you actually go out and count these other things. It's argued counting the bread is in and of itself also counting the flour and the wheat. So we've already counted everything, allegedly. And therefore, if you now go out and count in addition to the bread, the flour and the wheat, then allegedly you're double counting. Now, one of my main points is that when you count the bread, that is in fact all you are counting. And the people who think that you're counting the flour and the wheat are making two major errors in violation of the laws of mathematics. What they're doing is they're looking at the fact that you can express the value of bread as equal to the value of the flour plus the value added by the baker. You could say bread is equal to A, the value of the bread, B, the value of the flour plus the value added by the baker, or C, the value of the wheat plus the values added by both the miller and the baker. Now, these are three alternative valid ways of expressing the value of the bread. But if you adhere to the laws of mathematics, in all three cases, you've still expressed only the value of the bread. Because when we say the value of the bread is equal to the value of the flour plus the value added by the baker, we're not allowed to forget that part of the formulation is the value added by the baker. And if we keep that in mind, alongside of the value of the flour, what have we still got?
Right.
Only the value of the bread. Now, those who think that we have, in addition to the value of the bread, also the value of the flour, what they're doing is dropping out the value added by the baker, which is illegitimate. That's a violation of mathematical law to throw away terms of equations. You can't just arbitrarily subtract terms of equations and forget about them. So that's one error. But then after that, what they do is they add up the remainders of those equations in violation of the fact that these are mutually exclusive formulations of the same thing and therefore not subject to addition. So one could say legitimately the value of bread is equal to A, the value of the bread, or B, or the value of the flour plus the value added by the baker, or the value of the wheat plus the values added by the baker and miller, but it is not equal to the value of the bread and the value of the flour and the value of the wheat. To come up with that, you have to throw away the value added by the baker, throw it away twice, throw away the value added by the miller, and then add up these remainders of mutually exclusive formulations, which are not properly addable. And so those are the two mathematical errors involved in the view that the final product counts more than itself. And if we want to count everything, which we're obliged to do if we're studying macroeconomics, we have to count not just the value of the bread, but also that of the flour and wheat, and similarly for all other products. Yes, Mr. Wright.
I don't want to return to this.
That's okay.
But yeah. Is the thinking of a contemporary economist then that the final product, the bread, because costs are passed on to the consumer, those somehow are contained then in the bread?
Well, they think it's contained in the bread because you can say the bread is equal to the profit of the baker plus his cost.
Right.
But you can't say that the bread, it counts the bread and its cost. The bread is the profit plus the cost, which still is just the value of the bread. Now, we have an amazing state of affairs. Macroeconomics is supposed to be the study of the entire economy. But the way it's presently conducted, it reduces to the study essentially of just consumption. of consumers' goods. Now, I could teach the contemporary doctrine. I'd be teaching something. If I didn't point out what's wrong with it, I'd just be teaching something I believe was utterly fallacious, and while I knew better. So there is such a thing as academic freedom, the right to pursue the truth and to propound it. I'm not making a secret of alternative views, and you can easily access them, and I present them. All right, so here we are now. We're at the point where we express national income as equal to sales minus costs plus wages. It's sales minus costs plus wages. That is true. Does anyone have any problem with the accounting aspect of that? Anyone who doesn't see that if we took the totality of all business sales revenues for a period such as a year and subtracted the totality of the costs that the firms deduct from their sales revenues, we'd have economy-wide aggregate profit. And if we add to that all the wages and salaries, we have national income. Anyone have a problem with that?
No.
Okay, good. Now, that's still national income, but as I've said, you would not even be allowed to formulate it that way if you followed the contemporary procedure, because they never get to looking at total sales revenues. They think, well, we can't look at that. That's already counted when we've counted the consumer sales revenues. By now, we're going to look at the total sales revenues in equation 4, S, and we're going to look at them from the perspective of the purchasers. Anytime a firm has a sales revenue, it has to have a customer who's spending money that constitutes the sales revenue. And there are only two possible motivations of the customer. The customer is making his purchase either for the purpose of himself making subsequent sales implicitly at a profit, or not for the purpose of himself making subsequent sales.
Consumption?
Yeah. And does anyone have a problem with recognizing that any dollar of sales revenues, when looked at from the perspective of the customer whose purchases constitute the sales revenues, from the perspective of the customer, the purchase is either for the purpose of himself making subsequent sales revenues, or it is not for the purpose of himself making subsequent sales revenues.
So therefore, for them to consume or for them to buy it as a capital good to go do something with?
Yeah.
Use more.
Exactly. If we look at General Motors, if we look at the sales revenues of General Motors and its dealers, all of those automobiles purchased for personal use by different individuals. Under the heading of what type of expenditure would you put that? Consumption expenditure or productive expenditure?
For themselves.
Consumption. It's consumption expenditure, not for business purposes, for their own personal use.
Would you repeat?
All of those sales revenues of General Motors that are constituted by expenditures made not for the purpose of making subsequent sales.
Yes.
Where does that belong? Under the heading of consumption expenditure. That's clearly consumption expenditure. That's sales revenues constituted by consumption expenditure.
Right.
Okay, now, what about all of General Motors' sales revenues that are made by automobile rental agencies, by taxi cab fleets, by business firms for business purposes?
Correction.
Those are expenditures made for the purpose of making subsequent sales, so they are productive expenditures. And General Motors has some other types of divisions. They have a truck division. Certainly their larger trucks, the sales revenues would be for business purposes, that would be productive expenditure. They have, or did have, I assume they still do, they have a diesel locomotive division. To the extent that freight railroads are buying diesel locomotives, and the freight railroads are privately owned, they're business firms in business for a profit, they would belong clearly under the head of productive expenditure. Yes?
Question. If I have a business and I purchase a General Motors product to use for my business, then I have made a production purchase.
Yeah, productive expenditure.
Okay, but I also use it for personal, so is okay. It like...
Okay, is, good question. You have a car which might be registered in the name of your business, but you're also using it for personal use,
right.
Okay? Now, for income tax purposes, you and I will all agree it's purely a productive expenditure.
It's, of course.
It's deductible. All right, but now, there are rules on this, IRS rules, where you have something that has a divided use. An automobile might be one. Your home, suppose you have a home office. And let's say it's a legitimate home office, but it's not your whole home. Well, how are you allowed to treat that on your income tax return?
The percentage of
that. A percentage. So if you have a 7-room house and 1 room is your office and that's for business purposes, then you would legitimately, from the point of view of the tax code, you could deduct 1/7 of the depreciation on your home, 1/7 of the mortgage interest, 1/7 of any common overall total household expenditures pertaining to the house. And that would be the principle, because here you are, it's one good, the house, but you're using one fraction of it for business purposes and the other fraction for consumption purposes, and it's your purpose that's determining whether it's a productive expenditure or a consumption expenditure and to what extent. And that's how we'd apply it. Now, there are many cases, businesses have a car registered in their name, but that's just a cover for purposes of tax deduction. So when you report your taxable income, you're deducting that expense, but in reality, it's a consumption expenditure, but I'll keep your secret. Here we are. We have total sales revenues, and we want to look at the totality of sales revenues from the perspective of the customers whose expenditures constitute the sales revenues. And I'm saying here in equation 4 that the totality of business sales revenues breaks down into two parts. One I call S sub C and the other S sub B. S sub C is all of those sales revenues which from the point of view of the purchasers are consumption expenditures. S sub B is all of those sales revenues which from the point of view of the purchasers are productive expenditures. So if we're dealing with General Motors, it's sales revenues from people buying their personal automobiles for non-business purposes. That's part of consumption expenditure. The sales revenues that GM has from Hertz or whoever, or National Car Rental, or taxi cab fleets, or private corporations, that's all part of productive expenditure. The sales revenues of the steel companies would virtually all be productive expenditure. The sales revenues of the iron mining concerns would be productive expenditures, and on and on. So whatever sales revenues there are, we will be able to classify any given dollar of them as either a productive expenditure or a consumption expenditure. If it's a consumption expenditure, we call it S sub C, that part of total business sales revenues which is constituted by consumption expenditure. S sub C is that part of total business sales revenues that is constituted by consumption expenditure. S sub B is that part of total business sales revenues that's constituted by productive expenditure. And we call it S sub B because P is used up for profit. So think of B as business expenditure. S sub B is that part of sales revenues paid by other business firms. It's productive expenditure. But let's look at the big picture that all sales revenues in the whole economy do break down into two main subcomponents from the perspective of the buyers. One subcomponent is business sales revenues that, from the point of view of the buyers, constitute consumption expenditures. The other subcomponent is business sales revenues that constitute productive expenditures from the point of view of the buyers. And we express that, we say total aggregate sales revenues, S, is equal to S sub C plus S sub B. Can you guys see this in the far back? Mr. Boisseau, can you see this?
Can we get a little bit bigger?
We can see it.
A little bit bigger.
A little bit bigger? Okay.
It's on page 701.
That's good.
Okay. All right, now we do the exact same thing in equation 5 for wages and salaries. Total aggregate wages and salaries in the economy, RW. And we look at these wages and salaries from the perspective of the employers. Are the employers paying these wages and salaries in order for themselves to be able to make sales at a profit or not, but not for that purpose? To the extent that wages and salaries are paid for the purpose of the employer being able himself to make sales at a profit, we say that, that's productive expenditure. Those wages and salaries are paid by productive expenditure. To the extent that employers are paying wages and salaries not for the purpose of making sales revenues, they are consumption expenditures. And the leading examples would be the payroll of the government. Apart from that, in modern circumstances, the only other instances would be housemaids employed by housewives, rich people's personal chauffeurs and butlers, things of that kind. The overwhelming bulk of wages and salaries are paid by business firms and would be classified as productive expenditures. Yes, Ms. Nikolova? Consumption expenditure, in which case we call it W sub C. That's the part of total wages that, from the point of view of the employers, constitutes consumption expenditure. And then all of those wages that, from the point of view of the employers, constitute productive expenditures, we call W sub B. So total wages break down into these two subcomponents. And I call these four components, SC and SB, WC and WB, I call them revenue hyphen expenditure subcomponents. Why? Well, they're revenues when looked at from the perspective of the sellers. They're expenditures when looked at from the perspective of the buyers. Okay, now the next step is, after we've gotten equations 4 and 5, we substitute those two equations back into equation 4. Now, back into equation 3. Here's equation 3, sales minus costs plus wages is national income. Now we're up to equation 6, and we're substituting 4 and 5 into 3. Well, back in 3, we had simply S, and we had W. We had sales minus cost and wages. Now we have, instead of sales, we have that part of sales which is paid by consumption expenditure, that part of sales which is paid by productive expenditure, and we're subtracting costs from the two together. And instead of just wages, we have that part of wages which is paid by consumption expenditure and that part which is paid by productive expenditure. Does anyone have any problem with equation 6? Do you see that that's still national income? It's just national income is now being expressed not simply in terms of sales minus cost plus wages, but it's being expressed in terms of revenue expenditure subcomponents. From two of them together, we deduct costs, we have profits, from the other two add up to wages.
Yep.
Okay, so we can proceed beyond equation 6. And now we proceed to equation 7. And all we're going to do in equation 7 is change the order of addition. We're just going to change the order of addition. In equation 6, we were still adding things up from the perspective of the kind of revenue or income. We had two components of sales revenues grouped together. We had the two wage components grouped together. We had sales minus costs plus wages. We were still looking at things from the perspective of the type of revenue or income that was involved, profit or wages. Now we're taking the same exact set of terms, but we're adding them in a different order. Instead of adding them in accordance with their revenue or income type, we're adding them in accordance with their expenditure type. So we're grouping the two subscript C terms together and the two subscript B terms together. Here we are. We still have that part of sales revenues which is paid by consumption expenditure, and we're grouping it with that part of wages which is paid by consumption expenditure. And we're grouping that part of sales revenues paid by productive expenditure with that part of wages and salaries paid by productive expenditure. And we're moving the deduction of costs over to here. Instead of deducting it from sales revenues, we're going to deduct it from productive expenditure. Now, does anyone have any problem seeing why this is still national income? I mean, it makes no difference mathematically whether we add A plus B or B plus A. It's the same thing. You can change the order of addition. Okay, well now all we have to do in equation 8 is realize that these two subscript C terms, when added together, represent total consumption expenditure, capital C. Total consumption expenditure, as far as it enters into aggregate economic accounting, is the sum of business sales revenues paid by consumption expenditure plus the wages and salaries paid by consumption expenditure. Together, they represent capital C. This is consumption expenditure for goods and services purchased from business firms plus consumption expenditure and payment of wages equals total consumption expenditure constituting revenue or income. And then we do the same thing for the two sub B terms. We add up the part of sales revenues paid by productive expenditure with the part of wages paid by productive expenditure, and we have total productive expenditure insofar as it constitutes sales revenues or income payments. And then we substitute 9 and 8 into 7. 7, recall, was this. We're substituting capital C for these two terms, capital B for these two terms. And so we arrive at equation 10. Consumption expenditure plus productive expenditure minus D, which is the same costs that are deducted from business sales revenues, these three terms taken together still equal national income. We're now expressing national income from the perspective of expenditure types. And we've got C, consumption expenditure, plus productive expenditure, minus costs, equals national income. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
My apologies. Could you go back to step eight, just not to go through it in detail, but just progress us again from 8 to 10. I lost us on, I understood why you grouped like SC with WC on 7.
Yeah.
But then when we went to 8, somehow I just kind of lost it.
Okay, well, 8 is simply expressing S sub C and S sub B together. It's saying if we add the two together, we can express the sum of the two as capital C. That's total consumption.
Okay.
Total consumption is the sum of that part of total consumption, which is demand for consumers' goods, S sub C,
okay,
plus that part, which is demand for consumers' labor, W sub C.
Gotcha, thank you.
Okay, and then the same thing for productive expenditure.
Thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome. So here we are in equation 10. We have national income is equal to a sum of consumption expenditures C plus productive expenditures B minus D. Now, if you stop to think about this for a moment, if we think back to where we started from, profits plus wages, and think in terms of sales minus cost plus wages, well, all of the sales and all of the wages are either consumption expenditures or productive expenditures. And so if we have sales minus cost plus wages, and all the sales and all the wages are either consumption expenditures or productive expenditures, well, now we have the consumption expenditures and the productive expenditures minus the cost. It's still the same thing, it's just expressed differently from the perspective of the buyers rather than the sellers, and we're subtracting the same costs. So if we have the same magnitudes, we have the same set of magnitudes, we have to have the same result, national income. Now, we have only one significant step left, and that is to realize that B minus D, productive expenditure minus costs, that is equal to net investment. Now this takes a separate demonstration, but I'll ask you to go on the assumption that this is true for a few minutes until we can prove it. If it is true that productive expenditure minus costs is net investment, well, then what do we have? That's expressed in equation 11. What do we get if we substitute 11 back into 10? What do we have national income finally equal to?
Net
cost.
Consumption plus investment.
Consumption plus net investment. C plus I, that's consumption plus net investment. So now here we are, we've started with national income, and we've gone through a series of steps, and we're ending with national income is indeed equal to consumption plus net investment, just as is claimed in all of the textbooks. That's a true relationship. They are equal. But we have vastly better insight into the equality than you'll find in any of the textbooks, because we see what are the underlying, the deeper elements that are generating it. And we are in a position to see the role of productive expenditure, which you would never get to see otherwise. Now here in 13, I give a kind of full summary statement of the essentials of everything. We have national income is profits plus wages, which in turn is equal to that part of sales revenues paid by consumption plus that part paid by productive expenditure minus cost. These three terms are still profits. And wages, that part paid by consumption, that part paid by productive expenditure. This is still profits plus wages. And then all we're doing is we're changing the order of addition. We have the two sub C terms and the two sub B terms. They're taken together. We're subtracting the cost from the two sub B terms, and we have consumption expenditure plus productive expenditure minus cost. B minus D is I. And so we have C plus I, that's NNP. What remains to be done here is to show why and how it is that productive expenditure minus costs is indeed net investment. Let me know if I need to back up and go over anything up to this point, other than why productive expenditure minus costs is net investment.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
For study?
Yeah.
Page 701, really give a nice description of each formula. So
yeah.
As long as we focus on the flow and descriptions in this on this page, we should be okay, right?
Well, you need more than this page to understand the concepts, I think.
Right. Yeah. But
this would be a very good review, and this is good. This is good for understanding what national income, the relationship between national income and net national product. Okay, now what we have to do is turn to showing why it is that net investment is productive expenditure minus business costs, the same costs that are deducted from profits in business income statements. But before I get into that, I need to know, do I have to go over anything further? You know, at a wedding, they say, speak now or forever hold your peace. So please speak now.
Good.
Never bought into that anyway.
You never bought into that anyway. Okay.
That's why you're not married.
Okay. All right, let's turn to the demonstration of why it is that productive expenditure minus cost equals net investment. Now, how many of you have had a course in accounting? Is there anyone who hasn't? Okay, well, that's very, very good. That will be helpful. I think the discussion should be clear to you all. I have a brief discussion of the elements of a balance sheet and income statement. and let's look at first these elements of a balance sheet, because what I want to try to show is that there are some major connections between items that appear in income statements and items that appear in balance sheets. And when we understand these connections, we'll see exactly why productive expenditure minus costs does in fact represent net investment. So the essential bare bones assets of business firms, I think, are first of all, cash and equivalent, gross plant and equipment and other fixed assets, less an accumulated depreciation reserve. And when you subtract the accumulated depreciation reserve, you have a net plant and equipment and other fixed assets. And then there's inventory and work in progress. Now, it's also true that an important asset of business firms is accounts receivable. We're neglecting that because that's a credit item. If you're doing business extending credit, you've got accounts receivable. We're looking at things more simply than that. We don't need to get involved with the credit aspect when we're first getting started understanding the essentials. So we ignore accounts receivable. The essential physical assets are cash, gross plant, and other fixed assets, the factories, the store building, the equipment, the fixtures, less an accumulated depreciation reserve. That gives you your net plant account. And then we have inventory and work in progress. And of course, the sum of the borrowed capital and the equity capital will add up to these two items, to these various items. Now let's consider how does gross plant get on the books of business? What gives rise to something being entered on the balance sheet as part of gross plant?
Purchase.
It's a purchase. Business firms are buying things. If they're buying, let's say, a new computer, they paid so much for the new computer. What they paid for the computer will now be added into their gross plant account. What they paid will be added to the magnitude of gross plant. Now, if they're constructing a building, they're not buying the building as such, but let's imagine you're constructing a factory building, and you're making payments as the building progresses. Then your payments as the building progresses would be added into your gross plant account. So it's expenditures, and what is done with your expenditures, with your payments as the building progresses, you might do it yourself if you're acting as your own contractor, or if not you, your actual contractor. What would they be doing with the money that you're dispensing?
Paying your expenses.
What would they be spending the money on?
Materials.
They're buying construction materials. They're paying the wages of construction labor. They're perhaps renting equipment. Okay, so your expenditures for plant and equipment have a counterpart in what, in terms of other firms' sales revenues?
Productive increase in expenses.
As you're laying out money for plant and equipment, or buying equipment, what does that represent in terms of the sales revenues of other firms?
Expenses.
Well, they have sales revenues to the extent you're buying equipment or construction materials or renting equipment. That's sales revenues of other firms, right?
Right.
Your productive expenditure that's being capitalized into fixed assets, that's sales revenues to other firms. To the extent your outlays for the buildings are paying wages, well, that's wage and salary payments. That's part of the demand for producers' labor. Okay, and then the wage earners presumably will be spending their incomes buying various things from other vendors, and that will show up as a demand for consumers' goods. The wages you pay in constructing your plant and equipment, that will indirectly represent receipts from the sale of consumers' goods when the wage earners consume their wages. Now, in your income statement, one of the items that appears in virtually every income statement is depreciation. Depreciation is one of the deductions from sales revenues. It's part of the costs deducted from sales revenues. Now, that much we all know. But that same depreciation that appears in business sales revenues as an income statement item also has an effect on their balance sheets. And how does it show up on the balance sheet?
Comes off the assets.
Pardon me? They reduce the assets by virtue of being added into the accumulated depreciation reserve. So let's work a simple example. Let's suppose we have a firm that spends $1 million buying new computers in the first quarter. All right, where will that $1 million go on this hypothetical balance sheet?
Assets.
Okay, it goes under the heading gross plant and equipment. So they're spending $1 million for computers. That's part of productive expenditure, and it's added into, debited into gross plant and equipment account. Now, let's say that this is their only expenditure of this type for the year, and that they're using these computers for the full year, and we'll assume the computers are depreciated over a three-year life. Okay, what would be the income statement charge accompanying the expenditure of $1 million for new computers? Okay, $333,333. That would appear in the income statement as a cost item. And how does it appear in the balance sheet? It's an addition to accumulated depreciation, right? Okay, so we would have $1 million added to gross plant and equipment and $333,000 added to accumulated depreciation reserve. What is the effect on the net plant account for the year? It's plus the difference, 666,67. So here we are. We've added $1 million in productive expenditure for plant and equipment, and we've added $333,000 in current depreciation, and there's an implied effect on the balance sheet, and that is the net plant increases by the difference, 666,667. Now, why is this? Well, productive expenditures for plant and equipment are additions to the gross plant and equipment account on the balance sheet. Depreciation cost is an addition to the accumulated depreciation reserve, which is subtracted from gross plant to give you net plant. What is the effect on net plant to the extent we're adding to gross plant and incurring depreciation? Well, net plant will increase to the extent there's a positive difference. So if we're spending $1 million for new plant and equipment and we have depreciation of $333,333, net plant will increase by the difference. Well, notice this represents net investment in plant and equipment. The net investment in plant and equipment is the increase in the net plant. Net investment in plant and equipment is the increase in the net plant. And the amount of that is the difference between the current plant and equipment spending and current depreciation. Any problems with this? That productive expenditure for plant and equipment minus depreciation cost is equal to net investment in plant and equipment. Yes, Mr. Wright.
So if you depreciate a piece of equipment over a one-year period, you would have a zero.
If we depreciated the computers in 100% in 1 year, we would then spend $1 million in that year, and we'd have depreciation cost of $1 million on their account, and there would be zero net investment in plant and equipment.
Okay.
That would be true. Now, notice also, suppose we have computers available this year that we purchased the year before, and we're not making any new purchases, but we're incurring depreciation. And we have the fresh $333,333 of depreciation. What's the effect on our net plant account?
Decrease.
It would decrease by the amount of depreciation. So depreciation operates to reduce the net plant account. Plant and equipment purchases operate to increase the net plant account. The difference between the two is the change in the net plant account. The difference between the productive expenditure additions to gross plant and the depreciation additions to the accumulated depreciation reserve, that's the change in the net plant account. The depreciation is a subtraction. The expenditure for new plant and equipment is an addition. The difference between the additions and the subtractions is the net change. Now, if we look at the bare bones elements of an income statement, we've got depreciation. We also have cost of goods sold, and we have selling, general, and administrative expenses. And after we subtract these three, we have net profit before taxes. Yes, Mr. Sweeney.
I want to back up. So you're saying basically the delta net plant is equal to the investment. So in the case where you took computers from purchased last year and depreciated this year, there's no further purchase of equipment, then your investment is minus 333?
Yeah. If you're incurring depreciation and you don't have current new expenditures, your net plant is shrinking, your net investment would be negative. You can have negative net investment in plant and equipment. That exists anytime depreciation surpasses new spending for plant and equipment.
So investment is the delta in net?
Would be negative. You can have negative net investment. That occurs anytime depreciation surpasses current plant and equipment spending.
But not balance.
Pardon me?
Spending, but not balance.
The balance sheet is not negative. You have a negative net investment if the net plant and equipment account gets smaller. It's still positive on the balance sheet, but less than it was the year before. So that's a negative movement. It's a reduction. All right, so we have these further elements of cost. We've looked at depreciation. It's a cost item. It's also a factor that enters into the balance sheet that operates to affect net plant and equipment investment. And we also have cost of goods sold and selling, general, and administrative expenses. Now, on the balance sheet, we also have inventory and work in progress. That's the item that relates to cost of goods sold. Now, notice when firms are making expenditures on account of inventory. Like suppose we look at some outfit like the Sofa Factory. I think they're a retail establishment. Let's say the Sofa Factory spends $1 million buying sofas at wholesale from sofa manufacturers. What's the accounting treatment of that? How does that appear? Would they take their $1 million outlay and say, oh, that's a cost we're deducting from sales revenues because we've spent $1 million.
It's inventory.
It's inventory. It's debited. It's debited, added to inventory. The money that a retailer spends to buy stock, his merchandise, from a wholesaler, that's an addition to his inventory. If you have a manufacturing firm, what they're spending for materials to put in their warehouse, that's an inventory expenditure. That's a productive expenditure on account of inventory. Large firms have accurate cost accounting systems. So not only would outlays for materials be going into inventory or work in progress, but so too with the wage payments of manufacturing labor, at least the direct labor. Imagine General Motors is spending a certain amount of money for steel sheet, and it's also paying wages to workers in its factories who are processing the steel sheet and the other inputs that are purchased. But even after some processing has gone by, General Motors now has a supply of semi-produced automobiles. It's not just the raw materials, it's automobiles at different stages of manufacture. Or they've got an inventory of automobiles sitting in their lots. How would they be calculating the cost value of those inventories? It would include the wage payments along the way, as well as the outlays for the materials. So outlays by business firms for materials, components, supplies, and wage payments, at least to manufacturing labor, and in construction firms, to construction labor. These are wage payments that are debited into asset accounts. So notice, here we are, we're now in the month of November. General Motors and other firms are making current outlays to buy from their suppliers. They're meeting payrolls. When do you think the automobiles that they're turning out now and next month in December, when do you think they're going to actually get into the hands of the automobile buyers and be paid for?
Well,
Probably sometime early next year, January and February. But General Motors probably has a fiscal year, I think, that ends December 31st. So when they calculate their income statement for 2004, and it turns out that in November and December, they've paid however many billions of dollars for various materials and wages and so forth, but they haven't yet sold that resulting output, where would those outlays show up? Would they be in the income statement as a deduction from sales revenues? They'd be on the balance sheet as additions to inventory or work in progress. They'd be inventory work in progress. Now, when you look at General Motors' income statement and they report a figure for cost of goods sold, what does that represent? Pardon me? Yes?
Material and labor against the goods that were actually sold to
consumers. Yeah, it's something that's coming out of inventory. When it's in inventory, there's an inventory value. The inventory value is based on the sums previously expended for the materials and wage payments and so forth. But until it's sold, that's an asset item. It resides in inventory. Only when the item is sold is the cost rung up. Then it's a deduction from sales revenues as a cost, but what is its effect on the inventory?
Reduces.
It equivalently reduces inventory. So notice, if you look at income statements and you see the item cost of goods sold, well, on the one side, that's a deduction from sales revenues in arriving at profits, right? But in the balance sheet, it's also a deduction from what? The inventory work in progress account. So notice, cost of goods sold has this dual relationship. It's an income statement item, and it also enters into the balance sheet determination of inventory work in progress. Now notice, when firms are making outlays for materials, components, supplies, paying the wages of manufacturing labor, their expenditures are not entering into their income statement, not right away. They're being debited into this asset account, inventory work in progress. It's only as you have cost of goods sold that you have an item in the income statement, and then it's a subtraction from the balance sheet. Well, this implies, I think, that the difference between the sums firms expend for inventories, supplies, components, and the wage payments of manufacturing labor, the difference between all that on the one side and cost of goods sold, that's the difference between pluses to inventory work in progress and subtractions from inventory work in progress. The productive expenditure on account of inventory work in progress is an addition to the inventory work in progress. The cost of goods sold is a subtraction. Well, what does this difference signify? Suppose we have an operation, it's spending in the given year, it has outlays of $10 billion on account of inventory work in progress. That's its total outlays for materials, components, supplies, and direct labor of the kind that they debit into inventory work in progress. And it has cost of goods sold, we'll imagine, of $9 billion. What does that imply about the effect on the value of their inventory work in progress? It's plus $1 billion. See, whatever they had, they opened the year with a certain value of inventory work in progress. If they spend $10 billion, or whatever it might be, buying materials, components, supplies, paying the wages of manufacturing labor, all of those sums are additions to this asset account. And to the extent that the firm is making sales out of its inventory, we have cost of goods sold, and the cost of goods sold is the subtraction from the inventory work in progress account. The difference between the sum of additions and the sum of subtractions is the net change in inventories. That's net investment in inventory. So notice we have now a close connection between what we've looked already at the two grand components of net investment. Net investment in the whole economy has two components. There's net investment in plant and equipment, and there's net investment in inventories. Net investment in plant and equipment, and net investment in inventories. And here we can look at the whole picture. we're out to show that productive expenditure minus cost equals net investment. Here's the totality of productive expenditure. Here's the totality of costs, and the difference is net investment. Now, what we have done up to now implicitly is we're looking at productive expenditure on account of plant and equipment, call that B sub 1. Productive expenditure on account of inventory work in progress, call that B sub 2. D sub 1 is depreciation cost. D sub 2 is cost of goods sold. And what have we got? What's the difference between B1 and D1? Productive expenditure for plant and equipment minus depreciation cost, that's what? Which is? Net investment in what? In plant and equipment. That's I sub 1. B sub 2 is productive expenditure for inventory work in progress, and D sub 2 is cost of goods sold. What's the difference between those two? Net investment in inventory, I sub 2. I sub 2 is net investment in inventory. Now, we have a third category here, B sub 3 and D sub 3. What are these? Well, in contrast to plant and equipment spending and spending on account of inventory work in progress, there are some productive expenditures which are not debited into any asset account. These are expenditures which are deducted instantaneously as costs. Typically in this category would be such things as newspaper advertising, possibly the payment of the salaries of executives and clerical workers, though not necessarily always. Let's suppose General Motors has an advertising campaign in the last week of December, not just newspaper, any television advertising, whatever. And in their Christmas advertising, they spend $100 million, or however much. And they have to have an income statement as of the close of December 31st. How would that $100 million advertising expenditure show up? That would not be cost of goods sold.
Marketing expense.
Well, that would come under the heading of selling, general, and administrative expense. Selling, general, and administrative expense, and that kind of expense is what I would call an expensed expenditure. Unlike plant and equipment spending and inventory work in progress spending, it's not debited into any asset account. It's charged off instantaneously. If you had an income statement that you had to post as of midnight tonight, then whatever outlays had been made since the last such income statement and midnight tonight of this character, they would appear as an expense item. They'd be part of the costs of that period. So if we had advertising today or last week, since our last income statement, those outlays would be deducted immediately. Now, I call such expenditures expensed productive expenditures. They're expensed productive expenditures. These are the productive expenditures that are costs instantaneously. They're costs the instant that they're made. They appear in the income statement as a cost in the moment they're made. Now, if that's the case, then we subtract from these productive expenditures costs of an equal amount, the costs equal to those productive expenditures, what's the difference?
Zero.
They net to zero. Well, here we are between B1, B2, and B3. We have the totality of all productive expenditures. And between D1, D2, and D3, we have the totality of business costs. And when we subtract the totality of the one from the totality of the other, what do we get? We have net investment. We have I1 plus I2 plus zero. That's I1 plus I2. Productive expenditure minus the same costs that business firms deduct from their sales revenues in calculating profits. When you take those same costs and deduct them from productive expenditure, you have net investment. Any problems on this? Now, under each of these types of productive expenditure, you have some of it will be productive expenditure that constitutes business sales revenues. Some of it will be productive expenditure that constitutes wages or salaries. Under B1, we have productive expenditure for construction materials, well, what is that from the point of view of the sellers? Sales revenues. We also have the payment of the wages of construction workers. That's a wage or salary payment. Under B sub 2, we have the purchase of materials, components, and supplies. Well, that's sales revenues to the sellers. And we also have substantial wage and salary, wage payments anyway. Maybe some salary payments too. That's wage and salary payments. Under B sub 3, we have, again, selling, general, and administrative expenses. What would be examples of the purchase of capital goods, receipts from the sale of capital goods under the heading of selling, general, and administrative expenses? What types of purchases from other firms would show up as a selling, general, and administrative expense from the point of view of the buying firm? Well, possibly rent, maybe. What?
Office.
Office supplies.
Overhead costs, electric bill,
Probably the electric bill, lighting and heating expense, advertising. Lighting and heating advertising, that represents sales revenues to the sellers. Paper clips, rubber bands, those are simple office supplies. You'd almost certainly expense them. So these would be expense, productive expenditures, and they're receipts from the sale of capital goods. They'd be under S sub B from the point of view of sales revenues. And the wages of clerical workers, perhaps sales help, they would probably be, well, they'd be S sub B also, W sub B, but they would probably be expense. They'd be under B sub 3. Mm. All right, well, I think we've shown then that productive expenditure minus costs, the same cost that we subtract from sales revenues to get profit, that's net investment. That's net investment. Let me say one last point about the relationship between productive expenditure and costs. People who don't know anything about accounting tend to ignore the difference between productive expenditures and costs. There are certainly strong connections. But when you allow for assets that business firms have, the plant and equipment, the inventories, a major chunk of productive expenditure you can think of as being parked in asset accounts. They're parked in plant and equipment accounts or inventory work in progress accounts. They show up as costs after an interval of time. They show up in costs as and when goods are sold and as and when the assets are aging or wearing out. They don't show up in costs instantaneously. Today's productive expenditures, to the extent they're for assets of one kind or another, you can think of as being costs appearing in income statements in the future. The costs that appear in income statements today are, to a large extent, productive expenditures made in the past. And whenever we have more productive expenditures being made in a given period than costs being incurred in that period, we have net investment. Net investment is the difference between the productive expenditures, which are added to assets, and the costs, which are being subtracted from assets. Yes, Mr. Wright.
I have one question. Suppose you depreciate something over 3, 5, 10 years, it doesn't matter. But at some point, then it's no longer, and you're not reinvesting, it's no longer a net investment. The only thing I would say is sometimes equipment is depreciated fully after 3 years, yet it's still in service 5 years from then, and it's no longer considered a productive expenditure, but you're still garnering revenue from it.
Right. Okay. So now when you have assets that are still in use, even though they're fully depreciated, they'd still appear on your balance sheet as part of gross plant, and the total depreciation would be in the accumulated depreciation reserve. And they presumably would be contributing something to revenue, but they are fully depreciated. They would only disappear from the balance sheet when they were retired.
Right.
So if you're no longer using them, if you scrap them, if you sell them, then you deduct them from the balance sheet.
You blow them up, like Hazlitt.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, you had a question first.
Yeah, okay.
Now, in your equations here that we're talking about, do you, are we going to have to worry about, I mean, I'm just wondering, in your contemporary economics course, they always tell you to calculate in, you know, the opportunity cost of everything. And so I'm wondering, is that going to come with later on? Or are we going to talk about that?
I don't think I'll give you anything that breaks it down to this detail, but you will get questions. If productive expenditure is X and costs are Y, what is net investment? Yeah, you'll have to know. You should know that productive expenditure minus cost is net investment.
But not opportunity cost.
No, we're not dealing with opportunity cost. In fact, hopefully, if you review that section, you'll see that I attempt to refute that concept.
It's out the window. All right.
Well, don't put it out of the window, but keep in mind what it is and also what is wrong with it.
All right.
Okay, now, I'm sorry, Ms. Herrera.
Depreciation.
What if you're leasing, like, say, copiers or, in the desk, office equipment? Who gets to depreciate the value of depreciation, or the company that you're leasing from, or do you get to depreciate it? Okay, that's a good question. You're leasing copiers or whatever. Maybe you're leasing furniture. You're leasing your storefront. You're leasing the store. All right, from your point of view, what you've paid would be an expense, would be a deduction in your income statement. I think it would appear under the heading selling, general, and administrative expenses. I don't think there'd be any element of capitalization involved. But the party who'd be charging the depreciation would be the owner of the assets. So if you're renting a space in a building, you're not depreciating, but the landlord is. If you're renting copying equipment, you're not depreciating it, but the copying company is. They're depreciating their equipment. It's the owner of the equipment who depreciates it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. All right, now, I have a reference here, net investment as the tip of the productive expenditure iceberg. If you recognize that net investment is, in fact, productive expenditure minus costs, that it's this enormity of expenditure. Under the head of productive expenditure, we have the spending for the flour and the wheat, the spending for the steel sheet and the iron ore, and all the rest of it. And net investment is the difference between the totality of all of this spending, together with wage payments paid by business, and the cost that businesses deduct. Well, this difference is going to be much, much smaller. The difference is net investment, but net investment is the difference between two huge sums. Now, it might be, would it be possible, do you think, that we could have a year in which productive expenditure and costs happen to be the same?
Yeah.
Would that be possible?
Yeah.
I would think it'd be possible. Would it be possible to have a year in which a productive expenditure was less than the cost?
Yes.
That would be possible too. In that case, net investment would be a negative number. But let's, for the moment, say that productive expenditure and costs are equal. Then net investment would be zero, right? And national income would then equal consumption alone. It would be mathematically equivalent to consumption alone. But still, where would most of the spending be?
Productive
expenditure under the head of net investment. When you look at net investment, it's zero, but that would be the difference between two huge items, a huge amount of productive expenditure and an equally huge amount of costs. Now, in a normal year, we have positive net investment, but it doesn't begin to indicate how large productive expenditure is. You might have, in a given year, $10 trillion of productive expenditure and $9 trillion of costs, and we'd have net investment of $1 trillion. Or it could be $10 trillion of productive expenditure and $9.9 trillion of net investment. But still, we have this $10 trillion of productive expenditure. That's actual spending. Now, I see that we're just like a minute shy of our normal break time. So let's take a break here, and then we'll be able to use this framework and see where the actual spending is going on. So I'll expect you all back in 25 minutes.